Hey guys, welcome to the next episode of the Dog Real Talk. This time we talk with Sarah Owings, who is an amazing trainer with whom I had the pleasure to work with during nosework classes. With Sarah, we talk about whether we need to sacrifice precision while working with so-called fragile dogs to have success. Stay with us and listen to our conversation to find out. Today's topic, I want to discuss, do we have to compromise precision when we work with so-called fragile dogs?
Okay, so this, this topic, I'm just gathering my thoughts because okay. I probably won't say anything the same as last time. no, but the answer is, of course, it depends. Mm-hmm. So, the way I think of every training session with any dog, regardless of the label we've decided that they are fitting into, is you can pull out what your primary goal is.
Yes.
And I really encourage my students to pick one goal per session. So if the goal is increased energy and speed and enthusiasm or whatever, however you define that, you might make it's a good clicker training to relax criteria on precision or things like that.
Okay.
Right? However, it's really good to balance that. And then you might put that dog in a situation where they're completely comfortable.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe at home, in the kitchen, and then focus very, very closely on precision. And eventually, I kind of like to toggle back and forth between the two modes, and eventually it comes together. So I never assume that a fragile dog can't be precise.
Yes.
But I like to pull the criteria out. And also, I really feel that precise criteria does not have to be deflated.
Pressure. Yeah,
it doesn't have to mean pressure or it's actually too wide criteria that I find creates pressure.
Exactly.
Because the animal is now confused. They actually have to problem solve too much. They have to try five things to get it right.
Yeah.
That's what starts to create the shutting down that you see. But if your parameters are very tiny, and you're doing these very precise approximations, they can get it right immediately, and that rate just keeps the momentum going. And so it really is kind of a myth, I think, that you have to sacrifice precision or that precision creates a dog that shuts down.
Okay. So it's a matter of a good training, not a matter of precision or a fragile dog. It's a matter
exactly.
of doing something clearly with a clear criteria. So the dog knows what's coming next, knows
right.
what behavior he is supposed to do, even if it's just a very simple behavior. Because I think people often got confused with precision and challenging behaviors, challenging complex behaviors and exercises. And
right.
precision doesn't mean you have to do the whole obedience course or agility or a full freeze alert on the first session.
Right. Well, that would be lumping to me.
Exactly.
That would be
yeah.
the opposite. That's to me the opposite of precision.
Exactly. Yeah.
So when you're sitting there going, dog, you're not getting it right because
mm-hmm.
I have a precise criteria,
yeah.
but it's a really wide, you know, it's a big leap.
Yep.
And you're sitting there. I mean, that is pressure, right? When you're sitting there and you have this specific thing in mind
mm-hmm.
and your dog hasn't had the approximations yet
yes.
to get there. And you sit there and wait, and the dog has the rate of reinforcement drops.
Mm-hmm.
And people think that's because of precision.
Yes, because you want the precise behavior or a part of the behavior.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. So that's not actually precision to me.
Mm-hmm.
That's the opposite of it. So, since nose work is pretty much what we think about the most, you and I, I can split my criteria on something like the nose is exactly on mark, but no duration.
Yes.
Or I could choose to build up a reinforcement history for the head going straight over odor, but not even reaching it yet. Or I can pull out the, I like to think of shaping out like on a breadcrumb trail from start to finish, and anywhere along that path is clickable as long as that momentum is building forward towards your goal. So certainly if I take one of my dogs into a very difficult area and they have to solve a very difficult puzzle, very likely I'm going to relax my duration criteria.
But yeah, because you have a history of building that very slowly, so you can go back one step and reinforce the easier step. It doesn't mean you are not precise with the criteria. It means you change the criteria, because this was the part of the reinforcement history also, the stage of learning. And you can just simply go back, because I think people really confuse. This was what I was recently even talking with some people, that they said that, I don't want to teach my dog a precise heel position. I just want him to be in heel. you know, just want him to take the heel position, and I don't care what he exactly does there. And this is something that will make this dog probably shut down if he is so-called and labeled fragile dog, or he will start barking and get many frustration behavior, because if you don't know what it looks like, how will you reinforce it, right? And you are unable to actually teach it. It's not about precision, because you can, you don't have to have a eye contact or exactly precise position in terms of like inches, how many inches he should be next to your left side, but you need to know what is the criteria, and this is the precision part. Because if you don't, whatever the criteria is, any criteria you have, it has to be precise. It doesn't mean it has to be complex and difficult in terms of physical abilities of the dog to do it, but it has to be clear. Otherwise, it's it will cause the dog to shut down if the dog is fragile.
It can, certainly can. And so I was talking to someone this weekend at a trial, and I just, we were talking about that, and I just said it, I really feel it honors the learner to be clear with what they need to do, because they want to be successful. So it's not limiting the learner. It's honoring the learner by saying, this is how to get the, this is how to get the right answer. So it's just a different way to look at it. But usually if you see people pressuring and you're having problems with pressure, very likely the culprit is lumping. It's not precision. Very likely.
And very likely, it's also, I would say that it's likely that they don't know how to get what they want in terms of teaching the behavior. And they want the dog to fill in the holes in training. Because they are, they want to get to the final point. And they think that the dog should know how to do it. And this unfortunately causes many, many troubles along the way.
Yeah,
I also think that often we don't teach people, the handlers who start the journey with dog training, what it means to be precise in criteria. And even because it doesn't matter for me if you're a dog sport person or you're a dog trainer, or if you have a dog and you just want to this dog to sit or stand or whatever, just a simple very behavior or walk on the leash. People are not used to clear criteria. And this is what causes many, many troubles, I think.
Absolutely. So it's very good, like you have that beautiful video that you've put out recently of the different types of sits. And that is, you know, a regular person wouldn't need that,
Course,
they wouldn't need that level of a different cue for a totally different muscle pattern that results in the sit. But if you do need that level of precision, it is so much, again, it honors the dog to have a different cue.
Because it's a different behavior, actually.
For it's a different, and for recognizing that it totally is a different behavior. Whereas you could see so many obedience people cue a sit, and for the dog's entire life, mm-hmm. that sit has been a very sloppy thing.
It's like the outcome, yeah. not the process.
Right. And then they are fussing with the dog because they have rocked back and they're not in the right place, yeah. in the front position, and going, but why aren't you, you know, sitting? And the dog is sitting.
Yes. And that's the criteria, you know, with the dog.
Right. Yeah. Right. And just the concept that you could have two different types of sits, mm-hmm. and teach them very precisely would change that whole dynamic completely. But most people would just think all sits are a sit. And
yes, sit is a sit. Exactly. Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. And I think that we very often forget that for a dog, if you have a history, for example, recently I have this example with my second dog, with Gapcha. I taught him healing long time ago. Not in a very good manner, mm-hmm. and there was a lot of lumping, and the history of the healing is terrible. So I started from the scratch to build another healing, mm-hmm. Because for him, healing in the correct position, in terms of my visualization of the correct position, is totally different behavior than healing mm-hmm. when he forges or mm-hmm. when he is staying behind. This is absolutely different behavior. For him, it's not like fixing a behavior. He doesn't understand mm-hmm. If I would like to fix his healing. He understands yes. if I teach him what he is supposed to do and right. what is clear criteria, because very often I hear people saying that they need to fix something and that they need to fix the behavior. And this is impossible, especially with the dog, with a learner that doesn't speak our language. And for him, heel position next to my left leg, precisely in one spot, this is one behavior. And the different behaviors when he's forging, it's totally different. And mm-hmm. there are two behaviors. Of course, I need to teach the one I want from the scratch. Right. Start early from the beginning and build it absolutely clearly with a very clear criteria. And yes, it requires precision, but I don't think this teaching him this will cause any shutdowns or being stuck, him getting stuck. Because if I do it just step by step, it doesn't mean that this is too much precision for him.
Right.
Yeah, I would say that he got stuck if I persisted with forging and asking him to somehow fill in the hole I did in training and guess what's the correct position.
Yes. Yeah. Although that does bring me to another issue, which I believe is true of all dogs. Certainly, dogs express confusion and stress in a spectrum of ways, but I think all dogs are sensitive dogs. All dogs, you know, I live with the spectrum. I have one dog that seems to be the high drive, resilient, mm-hmm. over the top, keeps working guy, yeah. and then I have the one that you know, if she doesn't get clicked once, she goes and lays down, mm-hmm. and supposedly that's, you know, their personality types or their breed types or whatever. But the reality is it's my Labrador that is more sensitive to mm-hmm. Misclicks and being confused. But what he does is he just will bark at me, or his energy goes poosh like this. And my other dog, because she's a long time clicker trained dog now, yes. with many repetitions of being successful, mm-hmm. many repetitions of getting the right answers, she is far more resilient now at this point, yes. to that moment of, hey, you figure this out. She's much more, she has a wider repertoire. She has more, she's actually a much easier dog to train in many ways, but it took time. When I first started with her, her first response to not being clicked, and also I was younger then, that was like 10 years ago, so I probably had a confusing criteria more often. I'm sure I still do now, but so we worked together through that, but she would do that thing where she would just go lay down, or and I had to really work through this idea, and there were two components that really brought her out of her shell. Mm-hmm. One was the Leslie McDivitt give me a break game, mm-hmm. idea, yep. which again, I didn't I worked on that separately. Okay. So I didn't say, we're going to be doing precise healing and I want you to initiate the game every year. So okay. What I did was, our goal was to play that game. Mm-hmm. And I'll just, so people know what that game is about. The game is about the dog initiates the training.
Okay. Yeah.
So you would start, usually you start in a relatively controlled area. So there's not too much interesting stuff to do.
Mm-hmm. So and you, yeah.
So a smaller area, but the dog can sniff and wander and do everything. There is no pressure. There's no nagging, no look at me, no QQQ, nothing. You let the dog just interact with the environment. And as soon as the dog engages with you, mm-hmm. you do some very simple, their favorite, easiest things, like hand touch.
Oh, yeah.
Maybe mm-hmm. once, twice, nothing more. And then you release them back to mm-hmm. go sniff again.
Get whatever you want, yeah.
And the goal is to release them before they start to fade out, before mm-hmm. they start to go. And you repeat this until the dog is begging you to work. Like, you can't get rid of them. And that's what happened, was after a while, it was like you'd say, go back and go sniff and take a break. And she would just be like, no, 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 I want more. I want more. I want more.
Yes.
So I worked on that. That was one component. And I did that a lot. And it didn't matter what behavior, mm-hmm. right? I stuck with things that were ridiculously easy for her.
Yeah.
Sometimes I would just click eye contact or mm-hmm. walking towards me, or I don't care.
Yeah.
So then the other flip side of that was, again, me learning how to be very precise with the criteria that I was teaching her.
Yeah, okay.
So I stopped doing really open-ended things like 101 things to do with the box.
Yeah.
I stopped doing things because that just freaked her out. Like mm-hmm. it was like handing her a pad of paper and saying, "Write me a novel." And she
first day of your new job.
She was like, "No, no, no, I can't do that." So I just started to can she push a ball with her nose?
Yeah.
And then I would split how many tiny steps could we get to learn that skill? And then can she walk over to a stool, put 2 feet on? I picked simple things that I wouldn't be pressuring her,
exactly. Yes.
right? But I split them down so she just got hundreds of good, easy reps in there. And over time, she became a training monster. Of just more, they want more and more and more. Those are the two, and I went back and forth. And then I did inject a little bit of jackpot type expectation mm-hmm. games.
Okay.
So I don't usually use jackpots for any other purpose other than to build anticipation. Mm-hmm. So they're not surprises, and they're not used to give information. So okay. I never say that was a better repetition. You get a jackpot.
Yeah,
that was a slow one. You get a kibble. I never do that because that's not the reason I teach a game with a cue, and she's expecting this thing to happen, mm-hmm. and it I could see she would just get pumped, and then as in that energy that expectation would start to bleed into the behaviors.
Oh, okay.
So I would get speed, and I would get.
Mm-hmm.
And the same thing, I would do maybe 1, 2, 3 repetitions only, and then jackpot, and we would run to a whole bowl of her breakfast and that kind of thing. So those three components over time created a really resilient dog.
This is so interesting because mm-hmm. this is exactly what I did, not knowing about the game, but this is just what I did with Gapcho, because he was labeled as a fragile dog, as a dog mm-hmm. that will easily shut down, as a dog that's not a really working type. And one day I just started from the start. So I built I called it a choice, right? So you choose if you want to work with me, exactly what you did. Mm-hmm. And if you, it's your choice, you can choose not to do anything with me. And I did just exactly the same steps led to him being right now a working monster.
Right, exactly.
I can get rid of him. Every time we go to a training session, he's like a crazy, crazy dog, even barking. He never barked, really. And right now, he's barking, he's jumping on me, and he is pushing me to start any interaction. And this was the same action, same path you took with building a break, right? A choice. You can come and work with me, or you can just go and sniff and do whatever you want. Focusing on very easy behaviors, some exactly eye contact or walking towards me, any easy stuff, and then working on me as a trainer and learning how to teach him. And this is thanks to Kay Lawrence, actually, because she's really strict with criteria and handlers, much more than she is with dogs.
Yes.
But yes, she really gave me a great lesson about how to be a trainer and a handler I want to be. So this is the same, I think this is, this is actually the clue of not having a fragile dog and creating a training monster.
Yes, yes.
Yeah, we can write a receipt, like how to create a training monster.
Yes, that's what I mean. And you got to be careful what you wish for, because it's a little difficult sometimes for us to like watch TV. Zoe went through a phase where she would jump onto the coffee tables and be like, ta-da, we are, look, it's my agility pause table behavior. I'm ready, you know.
Okay, Gapture, because he was really, because of his history, his rescue, and he was not really well-treated in his previous home, and he was afraid of the kitchen, so we really worked on building a reinforcement history of him walking into the kitchen, and right now he is showing us that, look at me, I can even climb on the table in the kitchen.
right.
This is right now not exactly what I wanted. But
you have to celebrate.
Yes, be careful what you wish for, because right now he's like, look at me, I'm on the table in the kitchen.
Right. And you do have to celebrate, like the day the dog grabs your shirt sleeve and tears it, or because they're too excited about playing, and
all like my gloves are destroyed right now.
Yes, and that's the day with this type of dog you celebrate. You would never, you know, jumping on people, all that stuff, all those things that we go, no, none of those things are necessarily, you know, I mean, you could certainly focus on teaching behaviors that are needed, but anyway, yeah, so I think it's really a myth. I think every dog comes to you with a lesson to teach you.
Yeah.
Definitely what I did learn from Zoe was what pressure really is. So sorry for the heavy breathing. I have a Labrador.
That's okay.
He's right here.
He wants to, hello,
there he is. There he is. If he's a little bit too noisy, I'll
maybe he wants to say something.
Yeah, well, it'll be loud if he does, so yeah. Can you go relax, please? Yeah, I know you had your breakfast. Yes, I know I'm being boring. Okay. So what was I saying about?
You were saying about dogs teaching us different.
Zoe did teach me about pressure, what it is exactly. And sometimes it was so subtle. It was, I have, and this is sort of tied into your idea of criteria, is I had a vision in my head of how a session would go.
Okay.
And I was a little locked into it.
Oh, yes.
Right? And that, even though I never correct my dogs and I never, I never think I get grumpy with them or anything, I could tell that she could feel that expectation sometimes. And I would see her start to just deflate a little bit. And what the give me a break game gave us a way to know what to do.
Okay.
So I was like, when in doubt,
take a break.
I would just release. I had a release cue, and I'd say, and you could just, and the more attuned you get to those little subtle signs, you know, of the dog starting to, or just, you know, you just overworked something a little bit too long, or
it happens.
It happens to any dog.
Yeah.
But the lesson she taught me there was just how important that is for all dogs, mm-hmm. is to watch for that and get your trainer ego to the side and but it's also very important, because we can talk about all these concepts, is do you have a specific thing to do in the moment that your dog is starting, you're starting to lose them? Yes. And how do you process that information? Emily, even Emily had a wonderful presentation at Clicker Expo about flow charts.
Oh, yes.
Do you know about that idea? Mm-hmm. Where you actually visualize in your mind every single thing that could possibly happen, mm-hmm. from the time the dog has come out of the crate, mm-hmm. to the end of your session.
Yes.
Right? And you visualize it and you go, if the dog does this, I will do this. If the dog does this, I will do this. And you draw out your flow chart so that at least in your mind, we're going to have a siren moment.
Okay.
Sorry.
Don't worry.
I think he's okay.
Oh, okay.
He's very serious about sirens. Sorry. I'll move him. I know this is like official recording, but.
Oh, it's a dog. It's a dog talk. So, you know.
Dog talk.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's all. It's just, mm-hmm. that was what she taught me. But believe it or not, Tucker teaches me that 10 times more.
Mm-hmm.
10 times more, even though he has a high level resilience in other areas, mm-hmm. in terms of, he seems very environmentally resilient.
Okay.
He is definitely resilient when there's any physical discomfort.
Mm-hmm.
Because he's a Labrador, he's very resilient, in terms of expending energy.
Mm-hmm.
Right, he doesn't fatigue very easily, and these are all things that I have to be very careful of, because he's a very easy dog to overwork.
Oh yes, absolutely. He's very similar to, from what you say, to Gatsek.
Yeah, but mentally, mm-hmm. if he's required to solve a puzzle or think about something that's kind of outside of his wheelhouse, you know, out of his, if I am not clear.
Oh yeah.
He just falls apart. It's mm-hmm. He starts to do heavy breathing. He starts to, you can see the agitation starting. Mm-hmm. And then if I'm really bad, I get barked at. And I, like I said, it's the same thing that Zoe taught me, right?
But on the other side. Yeah. It's
just right.
The other side of the coin. And I think people often mistaken these dogs, if we can label them, like Tucker, about being easily frustrated.
Right.
And right. I've heard someone said that, oh, because this dog is easily frustrated, he's not really good with shaping, and he's not really good with clicker training, because he gets so, he's barking every time I take the clicker, or he's just offering hundreds and hundreds of behaviors. And this is not easily frustrated dog. This is dog that was taught all these behaviors because of poor training.
Yes. And that's, again, a result of lumping. When you get a dog that goes, okay, that's, this game means I guess as much as I possibly can.
I will try.
And that when you have a dog that thinks that's what the game is,
mm-hmm.
then it means that the gaps in your criteria were so wide.
Yeah.
That your dog was able to learn patterns of filling in
different behaviors often.
Yes. And so, now I know very, very skilled trainers have that idea that the dog has sort of a Rolodex of behaviors, mm-hmm. and they roll through them and you pick one and pull it out and then work on it. But I've only seen the very, very most skilled trainers be able to teach the dogs the difference, mm-hmm. right? And those dogs, you know, I'm thinking Morton and Ceci, mm-hmm. right? The way they have this idea of putting stimulus control on stimulus control, and those dogs don't have that frustrated, frantic feel to them. They have this sort of just repertoire library. Mm-hmm. But the other extreme of an incredible trainer that I greatly admire is Hannah Brannigan.
Oh, yes.
Where it's the moment the dog comes out of the crate,
Yeah.
To the starting point, to the pine splicing, to back to the crate. There is no gap ever.
Yeah.
In there for the animal to start improvising.
Offering the, yeah, some junk behavior, right, you don't want. Exactly.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I recently did some training sessions following that. I mean, I'm usually pretty tight as well with my sessions, but Hannah's even tighter. And Tucker was so relaxed.
Because he knows what will come, yeah, becoming next, yes.
Yeah, and there was no gap for him to, yes, start.
Exactly, you know. Yeah. It's, I don't know if you have seen my chart about a perfect training session.
Yeah, I love
it. It's because a year ago, I started planning my sessions in a very precise way. Like, mm-hmm, what actually Hannah does. So from the start, I have everything settled before I take the dog, mm-hmm, and I visualize what I will do. And then step by step, I know what I will do with a dog between repetitions, what I will do between behaviors. I have an option to take a break, and I know what my dog will do. But I also think that if I had started this early with Gapcho, mm-hmm, when he was like your second dog, like Zoe, it would have been too much because first I had to work on choice, mm-hmm, and actually even it was much less advanced, but it was the first thing actually everyone should do if they have a so-called fragile dog, mm, to build this option to come in and out from the session.
Yes.
And then you have to structure your session. When you have this, you can start working on behaviors. And you can start working on structuring the session so there are no gaps and everything is planned. So it clears the whole session and it makes it fluent and there are no jank behaviors. There is just, right, clarity. And,
right,
the sessions are so short.
Right.
There is nothing happening in between. So you're just going from point to point. And that's it. Uh-huh. And the session is over. And recently, my sessions are like 4 or 5 minutes. And I do so much more than I did when I was doing like a 20-25 minute sessions.
I know. Yeah. Absolutely. But I did notice, I did have that question mark in, mm-hmm, when I was just focusing on Hannah's, yeah, tight, tight, tight. You know, she uses a treat magnet,
yeah,
to the starting point. And I was thinking about, well, where's the choice there?
Okay.
If you know, how do we fit that in? But it was there. It was things like the dog would go into the crate.
Yeah.
And you eat the food. Mm-hmm. And the start button was the eye contact.
Yeah.
Back up again. Mm-hmm. As soon as the eye contact came back, then the treat magnet was offered. Mm-hmm. And I actually did find ways to find places for the,
okay,
for, right, and I, when I switched back and forth between Zoe and Tucker, Zoe needed 2-3 seconds longer, mm-hmm, to eat the food, yep, kind of settle into the, and then think about it and then look at me, and then we would go, and I didn't have to rush her, it was adaptable is what I mean. There was a flexibility in there that surprised me, because, yep, my first response was, this is so tight,
there is no place for choice,
there is no place. Because I do have this is fun. I mean, a progressive education background, mm-hmm, with working with, okay, young children.
Okay.
And progressive education classrooms, mm-hmm, are notoriously messy.
Oh, okay.
They're notoriously open-ended. They're the goal is that you give them materials and the learners build their own understanding.
Mm-hmm.
You don't walk them step. You know, okay, you know, yeah, lock, yeah, step through. That's actually limits learning, mm-hmm, in some respects. So I have both models in my head.
Okay.
So I have this tremendous respect and love for the precision, mm-hmm, and that tiny little splices. I also love those moments where there is a pause in the, mm-hmm, rhythm and you see the animal thinking.
Okay.
And,
yeah,
maybe even tried something and then nope. And then on track. But you have to do that so thoughtfully.
Oh yeah.
Right.
That's
right. It can't just be willy-nilly, and it can't be just because you don't know what you're doing. Like, it can't just be because you're winging it.
Yes, and I think this is more difficult for many beginners. It's easier to have a very clear steps of what you are supposed to do.
Right.
And not to go with the flow, let's say. Just
right.
I think for some people that can be easier to know exactly what is coming next, because you really need to be a good observer, to be able to, and know your dog, know your learner, to be able to have more relaxed training session.
Right. Well, I'm developing an idea for Clicker Expo coming up. It's not quite fully formed yet, okay. But I don't know if you've ever seen that. It's a video of the pigeon that they taught the pigeon to shove objects, and they taught the pigeon to peck a banana. It was like a little banana hanging up.
Yeah.
And they taught the pigeon to jump up on things.
Yes. And then,
and then they put the pigeon in a chamber with a block. The banana was out of reach.
Mm-hmm.
And they let the pigeon think about it, essentially.
Yeah, resurgence. Yeah.
And the pigeon brought... those skills suddenly came in, you know, there, and there probably was a period of frustration of just wandering around going, how do I get, I think trying to get that banana and couldn't reach it. And then that moment of, oh, it's starting to push the block over under the banana and sitting. So I've been really thinking about that, because to me, that's the definition of resilience is when you have these skills, you have enough small components in your repertoire library that when you're given a bigger puzzle, a problem to solve, you don't fall apart and shut down. You have an option. I could try this. I could try this. I could try. And you don't get panicky that you're, and this actually happened to me doing Portal games with Dr. Rosales Ruiz at a workshop. And I didn't know that I was about to be put under an extinction
trial.
I was the learner, and so I got reinforced for behaving for quite a while, and then the reinforcement just stopped. And what was so interesting was that I did not quit. I just kept trying new things. I mean, I went for a ridiculously long time
just trying
things, and I don't even remember being overwhelmingly frustrated. And I was thinking, so why did that happen? And I was sort of joking. I go, well, that's the product of my progressive education, is this idea of just, I'll just keep working at it until I come up with the, so I want to be able to think about that for dogs. It's a little different than training a behavior for a sport.
Yes, right? Where you have to have a very, clarity and.
Yeah, and that's absolutely, you know, I mean, I believe in that completely for that. But for this, it would be, the idea would be to teach the dog certain skills, like pushing things, stepping up on things, kind of like that pigeon, and then testing them a little bit, but pushing them a little bit.
Yeah.
Right. With a very, very thoughtfully, though. It had to be done very thoughtfully.
Yes. Yeah. And also, it has to be done after certain learning has taken place.
Right.
Because otherwise, this is the problem of almost a lot of handlers, that they skip the part of teaching components.
Yes.
And if you don't teach them, if you have no long reinforcement history, then you cannot put this all together, because it will all fall apart and you will have frustration.
Right.
And probably you won't, there are not skills yet. There are just some behaviors in the repertoire of an animal. But they can quickly just disappear. I mean, not disappear, but go away. And then another behavior will emerge. And, but completely different, something you were not hoping for. And because you have not built a long reinforcement history of the particular skills you wanted to have.
Right. Right. And so, and you, again, it would have to be done thoughtfully. But anyway, I was playing around with, I mean, even a simple thing, like Zoe plays a game where she has learned to push a ball, kind of like try ball, only it's a little ball. We play it at home.
Oh, okay.
And the skill is basically push it to me. That's basically it. I backchained it. It was simple, right? But now the way we play it is I put the ball in the farthest corner of the house.
Oh, okay. Mm-hmm.
She has to navigate all the furniture. She has to make up her own ways to move it. She has to, and you should see her work this. Like, I remember the day that it went all the way under this table with this weird grate, you know, like a heater grate. And I thought, she's not going to want to go in there. No. And she figured out how to get it out of there.
Awesome.
And she, and so I, that, that's sort of a simple example of, I didn't teach her how to crawl under tables and use her paws instead of her nose and how mm-hmm. to, you know, I didn't teach her any of that. She had to make that up to get the job done.
But is it not what nose work is about, actually?
Exactly. I was thinking that too. Yes. And I did this with Tucker, just nose work is he has a very precise endpoint.
Yeah.
Very clearly defined. He knows exactly what he is working for.
Mm-hmm.
But when you send him out into a very complex environment, it's up to him now how to solve that and to get to the endpoint, to get to that final thing that's clear, right? That's clear. That part's not fuzzy. So I love it. And that puts the perfect marriage for me between the precision and the problem solving.
Creativity, And is it not that it's actually why we say, at least about nose work, that it builds self-confidence. And it builds ability to solve problems.
Because
actually, a dog, it's the same with what Zoe does with a bull. It's just using your nose, solving the same puzzle, because we never taught our dogs to how to precisely find odor, right? It's like you never really worked exactly through steps of solving, pulling odor. I mean, you gave them skills. But you never really led them through the steps, like, this is the only way how you have to do it. There is this is the only way, there are no other ways. And because this is creativity, and the dog has to learn by resilience sometimes.
Yes.
And by resurgence, and this is fascinating. Right now I just, like, it all, you know, puts in pieces, everything is it's great.
So, and I've been thinking more in nose work too, there are puzzles that I feel like the more the dog solves that type of puzzle, my guess is, and I started to see with the recent trial I just did, is the odor signature of an elevated hide creates an information in the environment. And suddenly I saw Tucker going, oh, I know exactly what that is. Like, instead of a lot of running around going, odor is everywhere, and sort
like
of
green dogs do.
Right. He was, I could see him go, okay, this one is elevated.
Yeah.
I'm going up. And then he started, and it was, everything got tighter and more confident and more.
Yeah.
And so that was amazing to watch, but it was a skill based on experience, because we're slowly starting to encounter these complicated hides more and more often. So, and that's not something, I mean, I did give him some skill with elevated, a progression. But I think it didn't, there's nothing to prepare him for the complexity of what elevated hides do in different environments. There's nothing,
with any hide, I would say.
That's true.
Maybe except containers. actually, you cannot teach the dog how to search. I mean, you can. You can teach a pattern. You know, the only one that is you have to use, because this won't lead anywhere. You wouldn't be able to trial with a dog that has learned only one way of searching for odor. This would be impossible.
Right. So
but it goes exactly to this bowl and every concept training, actually. And this is, we often forget about it. We teach dogs certain behaviors, but we don't teach them skills to perform other behaviors in different environments, which is really important. And this is something I would say extremely important in terms when we work with everyday behavior. Like, walking on leash.
Yes.
And
What are the components to that?
Exactly.
You know, pace changing.
Yes.
You know, whatever the behavior is. Walking in a straight line, you know, leash walking is stupid. You have to walk in a straight line and you have to walk at the wrong pace for yourself, for the dog's point of view. Exactly. But what are the component parts to the behaviors you're trying to teach? Eva and Emily also have that amazing, if you read their book, Agility Right from the Start, the concept of teaching agility behaviors before you get to the equipment. So around. So they would just, can you go around things?
Yeah, like a tree.
Through, under, over. And they would teach these, and it's brilliant because if you are make a mistake, you haven't messed up your dog's relationship to the cue of the equipment because you're just using objects that you aren't going to. So, and that's sort of the same idea, is that when you finally get to the agility, teaching the actual jumps and hoops and tunnels, the dog already has a skill set to apply. So there's no, there's much less chance of doubt or confusion or lack of confidence or however we want to call that. Or frustration. So it's the same idea, kind of. I've been thinking of it as a repertoire library.
Oh, yeah, that's a great term. Yes, it's a perfect term. I think I experienced this also with obedience and healing, because this is a very complex behavior. It's a sequence of behaviors, actually. And often you want a collected trot. You don't want a trot that goes too far fast and forward because the dog will forge. The dog needs to go a little bit up. And first, you need to teach the trot separately from the heeling, because if the dog can't trot this way, not in a heel, just normally, if it's impossible, if the dog doesn't have the skill, then it won't happen if you have him on the heel position.
Right.
And it's much easier to teach it first and then transfer it to heel position because you already have a skill you're working on.
Exactly. So it's the same idea.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And if you focus on teaching your heeling right from that, the idea of the eye contact and the stuck to your leg part, right?
Yeah.
Which are kind of outcome based. They're not actually skills so much as you know, so, and that's why you get this weird movement, because the body is twisted funny, trying to stick to your leg or keep their head up, and you get this weird kind of tension. And so if you really think about
often,
and often you get that, you know, the butt swinging out and lack of body awareness, but the handler is completely focused on, is your shoulder lined up with my pants? Right.
Exactly.
And so you can really get into trouble that way.
So yes, because we often forget about teaching skills. This is also, skills are not single behaviors. It's the ability actually to perform a behavior. And we forget it. We forget about it. And teaching skills, it's like a building the perfect library of our dog. So, and you can use it anywhere you want later.
And there are also, I like to teach dogs concepts, simple concepts, not, I'm not talking about advanced, I mean, I love advanced concepts, like match to sample, and that's always very exciting. But I'm talking about things like, do they really understand what a click is?
Yeah.
Right? Do they, are they showing you by their behavior that the click is registering?
Or going through the click,
Right? Like I get very doubtful when I see dogs that don't respond to the click at all. So they're getting clicked for holding position, and they're
delivery.
And they don't, and there's no move, that because they, you know, the person's going to feed in position and the dog doesn't even bat an eye at the click sound. I often question that and go, well, I don't think the click is even useful.
Yes,
in right?
It's definitely not a secondary reinforcement.
Exactly. So I say, well, does the animal understand what the click means? And I also really like to teach things like the concept of waiting for a cue.
I like to
teach that as a very separate skill. So rather than shape this complicated behavior and then get to the end and go, okay, now I want you to wait for the cue. I like to go, no, let's just work on waiting for cues.
Mm-hmm.
So I teach release cues separately. And for nose work, a lot of our students, you went through the program. That's why we do the chin rest.
Yes.
A simple behavior to teach the concept of you're going to hold position until
and duration. Yeah.
And duration until you're clicked. So that's we want to make sure the teams have that so that when we add the complexity of a search, find it, hold, mark,
mm-hmm.
if they don't have that first, that concept, it has much less effectiveness.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Right. So that's another example of just duration until clicked. Can you do that in the simplest way possible?
Yes. And it doesn't mean you have to, because people are often afraid of not reinforcing at source with nose work, right?
But yes.
It's because you didn't teach duration. And you didn't teach the concept of clicker.
And right. Well, most people don't want to use that. They feel like it's an artificial.
Yes, but often they use a marker, a verbal marker.
Mm-hmm.
That's actually what I did. So you reinforce at source, but you're afraid the dog will go back to you, you know, go to the height, even alert, do a freeze alert, and then quickly go back to you. But it means you failed with teaching him the criteria. It doesn't mean that this is the wrong method. It's not done precisely when a dog leaves the height before you click.
Yes.
Yeah.
And anticipation is, it really happens.
Of course, but it also happens if you reinforce at source.
But most nosework people don't really want duration, to be honest. They want the dog to stand there.
Mm-hmm. And it's different in Poland, actually. Here,
most people don't want that nose at source for a long time. They want the nose tap look back.
Yeah.
But they do want the dogs to stand there and insist.
Yeah, and don't move. That's true.
Which is a perfectly fine thing. But it's really not duration that they want.
No, it's a different behavior they want.
They think they want duration,
mm-hmm.
but they don't really want duration. They want a little chain of a nose pop, look back, stand there, wait for the food to come.
Exactly.
And I'm very, very clear, when that works for you, it works perfectly fine.
Yeah.
It works very, very well. When it doesn't, it's very hard to tell because there can be, you know, the anticipation. That's kind of interesting. The anticipation comes sometimes before they get to source. So you'll get the look back before because, you know, when there's a chain, dogs will skip to the part that gets them.
Yeah.
So if you don't have a good sourcing, nose touch, look back, and then that the source nose touch starts to get weaker and weaker and weaker.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Then you, right.
And you have misunderstanding and handler doesn't know and often says that the dog is false alerting.
Right. Right.
Which is not exactly true in this instance.
Yeah. Exactly. So, but alternatively with a marker trained dog like mine who anticipates, he will hit it. There will be duration, but I am learning that if I don't mark him within a certain amount of time, if I do that consistently, he and I both get in a rhythm and he will pop off and move on and start
to another hide.
Yeah. And so that's just a little weak spot in my training and criteria, that I'm noticing now.
It can be a matter of a different duration criteria. It's like if you always stuck to, 5 seconds, 3 seconds, 2 seconds, and it was always the same time, and suddenly you want to change something, then obviously, and especially with a dog that does many multiple heights, he knows what will come next.
Exactly.
And nose work is fun for them.
Yeah, so. But what's funny about him is he doesn't anticipate the reinforcer.
Yes.
So
I know
he goes on. He goes on. He just goes on. He goes, okay, I'll solve another puzzle then.
Yeah.
But he doesn't do the thing where he goes, well, why didn't you feed me? Because that's never been part of the, it's never, so I find it really fascinating that he doesn't do that. But
I had this situation with Gatsik recently. I even posted this on our thread with him. I even double clicked because I didn't know what to do.
I saw that.
Because he was like, he just left the hide and kept searching. And I was like, I clicked, and probably he didn't hear it, maybe.
Right.
He decided that, okay, duration passed, and now I'm keep going, searching for another hide. And he didn't look back at me. He was just like, okay, it's done. And then I'm searching, you know, for another one.
Yeah. It's funny. So we're getting on a nose work tangent because we're both, I don't know if you want to pull it back to our original topic, but all of this is tied in.
Yes. Because I mean, the precision and fragile dogs. I wanted to ask you also one thing. Do you think the concept of creating labels and telling people that this is a fragile dog and this is a high drive dog is in any form beneficial?
I'm thinking.
Because we both know that these are just concepts and labels. And
right.
They're not something that is inside the dog, as Dr. Susan Friedman says. But is it at any... Do you have a client, maybe, that you would say that it's easier to tell them this dog is fragile or high drive to make them kind of even sympathize with the dog and understand mm-hmm. the dog more, because this is the concept they use among even people. So it's easier for them to kind of understand the behavior if put a label.
It is, in a sense, like that. Humans are so... There's no way we can get them to stop labeling.
Yeah.
Like, we just can't. There's just no way. So sometimes it is better to replace a more harmful label,
mm-hmm.
like stubborn or dominant, or that's a very harmful label that is going to create a lot more misunderstanding and conflict, and even in the worst case, it could be abuse.
Yeah.
And if you replace that with things like, no, he's just high drive. He has a great heart. He's a courageous, he's a working dog.
Yeah.
You know, he's a working dog. That's why he's behaving this way.
Mm-hmm.
And give sometimes that can help. Mm-hmm. True.
You also have to give them some tools to work with this kind of a dog. I mean, to show them that you can change it if you do this and this.
Right.
Even if your dog is high drive, it doesn't mean he has to behave this way. He does it because, okay, he is high drive, but you can change it.
Right. But I don't know. I try very hard to walk that line of mm-hmm. we want more empathy for this totally strange species that really is, God, it's, yeah, I wish dogs had their own way of describing themselves, because I bet you it would nothing like what we call them. But we do need that empathy. I do feel though that it's another trap. You know, you then now you have a high drive dog that someone told you he needs to run 15 miles a day and chase a ball 500 times
mm-hmm.
because he's high drive, because that's what he needs and that's who he is. And then you're in another trap now, because that's not healthy for him either.
Mm-hmm.
So, like I said, I would think of it as an approximation.
Mm-hmm.
I would think of it as, well, okay, we're not going to alpha roll him anymore and put him mm-hmm. in prong collars and shock collars and fight him.
Yes.
But now we have to make sure we're heading in the right direction. So I probably wouldn't leave a label like that without some seeds of thoughtfulness.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
Because I noticed, I absolutely agree with you, because I noticed that it's really hard, especially in Poland, we don't have ABA, absolutely. I mean, this is such a new discipline, and we don't even have studies, ABA studies, and in with people. So dogs are absolutely based on some common knowledge and common sense, and sometimes it's so difficult to talk with people about behavior. Mm-hmm. Because they need a concept. And if I don't use this concept wisely, they're going to create it on their own. And they may even read on the internet that this dog is high drive, and because of that, he needs to run 15 miles a day. And if I do it, if I say to them, okay, your dog is high drive, but you need to do this and this, it may be less evil than if I leave them with just behavioral stuff.
Maybe. Yeah. I mean, I just like to plant some seeds.
Yes, definitely.
And sometimes you can do it very, very simply. Is mm-hmm. The pet owner will tell me a bunch of things mm-hmm. that are, you know, my dog is dominant or blah, blah, blah. And I just let it go usually. And then I say, well, this is, the reality is, you know, dogs are going to do what works for them. Mm-hmm. So let's look specifically about why that's working.
Exactly.
And I just refocus them on just, can you just look at that?
Yeah.
And that I go, that's just how we're going to solve this. If you really want to work on it. And that tends to help them start to just look at that a little bit more. But it's hard. It's really, really hard. I mean, I love, you know, Dr. Friedman's, you know, study of one.
Oh, yes.
Deeply. I love that very, very, in a very deep level of just.
Yeah.
Who is this individual being mm-hmm. right here in front yeah. of you? Now, they bring their genetics. Mm-hmm. They bring their history. They bring everything with them.
Yes.
But who is this being right here, right now? And why deny that being the ability to learn and grow and change? And because all living things can learn and grow and change, because that's what mm-hmm. we're hardwired to do. Certainly it doesn't mean turning your active dog into a couch potato yeah. or, you know, suppressing anything. It's about actually letting the true nature come out in a healthy way. That's what I try to do. So sure, Tucker has a very passionate response to toys.
Mm-hmm.
So we do a lot of toy stuff.
Yeah.
You know, so because it's his passion in life, like not because he should as that's, I mean, if he told me that that's not his thing, we would find another passion in life.
Yeah.
And, you know, and Zoe's passion in life usually is food. And laying in the sunshine, mm-hmm. And sleeping on the couch. So that's pretty much her passion in life. And they are absolutely unique
mm-hmm. individuals,
beings, yeah. you know? So I just try very hard to just respect that.
Yeah.
Every day that I go, well, and maybe even day to day or moment to moment, you know, how they are in the morning around meal times is a very different than how they are in the midday when they're sleepy, or there's just this flow of learning going on all the time.
Yeah.
So that's how I think of it, but it's kind of a deeper level that it's hard for everybody to go there.
Yes.
So like I said, sometimes it's approximation, all you can do.
Yeah. Okay, yeah, great. I think it's a great point to mm-hmm. finish our conversation.
Mm-hmm. Sounds good.
Okay, thank you so much. I really love talking to you.
It's likewise.
Great pleasure. And I hope it's, I mean, definitely it's safe this time, the file, the recorded file.
Mm-hmm.
We made sure of this. But I hope this is not our last conversation and that you will agree in some time to talk to me again.
Always. All always right. Happy to do that.
Next episode will air in a few weeks, and our next guest will be Hannah Brannigan, who is the biggest inspiration for me to do this program. Hannah is a host of Drinking from the Toilet podcast. Check her out before our next episode and subscribe for the Dark Real Dark program to be on time.